Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review, also co-author of Heavy Lifting. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And Jim, our good martini, we're happy to say, is for the most part election night. 2015 went very well for conservatives in some of the most high-profile campaigns around the country. A couple of local results I could quibble with, but in terms of the national picture, a couple of headlines stood out. First of all, in the race for governor of Kentucky, most polls had a small but consistent lead for the Democrat Jack Conway. In the end, it was Matt Bevin, the Tea Party candidate who took on Mitch McConnell and got clobbered in the 2014 primary. He barely won the primary to make it to the general election this year, ends up winning by 9 points in Kentucky. Huge win for conservatives there. In Virginia, Michael Bloomberg and his gun control lobby poured a ton of money into trying to turn a very narrow Republican majority in the state Senate into a Democratic majority that would go along with what Terry McAuliffe wants to do over the last couple of years of his governorship. That did not happen. All those millions of dollars spent, nothing changed. Still a 21-19 margin for Republicans. The Sanctuary City Sheriff, Ross Mirkarimi in San Francisco, crushed in a landslide, and a couple of cultural issues as well. The transgender bathroom bill crushed in Houston by 61%, and even legalizing marijuana in Ohio went down. As you point out in the Jolt, there's some other results around the country that we would have liked to see turn out a little differently, but on a lot of the big-ticket items, conservatives won the day.
Yeah, there's two things that kind of jump out about this. One is that, look, the off-year election before a presidential election year doesn't always have some of the bigger races. The three big gubernatorial races are, as you mentioned, Kentucky, Mississippi, and Louisiana. In Louisiana, we're going to have a runoff there and get a sense of whether David Fitter, the Republican, who's seen as a slight underdog, can win it. Now, you look at those states, it really should be a kind of, you know, the kind of year where Republicans just sweep them. They're all pretty Republican in presidential years. And yet, because of the quirks of the state and the local parties, Democrats have usually been managed to you know, get one of them. And Kentucky was the big exception last time around. And Kentucky was where the Democrats felt they had implemented Obamacare fairly successfully. Now, most of that was just a big expansion of Medicaid. But they believed, aha, look, we made it work here. Steve Beshear is this great success story. And Jack Conway, sure, he didn't succeed against Rand Paul. Sure, he didn't succeed in a House race. Sure, he didn't succeed. But he's going to, you know, he's a great state attorney general, and this guy's going to win the governorship. And the really weird thing, Greg, was that all the polling showed Conway with either a decent 3, 4, 5 point lead, or, you know, there was one Republican poll that had a tie. And when the smoke cleared last night, this was a you know, Bevin Lance, you know, near landslide, like a good 8 point victory. It wasn't even close. One, it kind of indicates that, yes, Kentucky is becoming a redder and redder state. And another, you know, in its further examination of the collapse of Democrats in the South, and whether or not you consider Kentucky part of the classic South. Probably one more point worth noting. I had tweeted last night, boy, I can't wait for the really awkward congratulatory call between Mitch McConnell and Matt Bevin. Because Bevin had run against McConnell in the primary and you know, been a – I think you say an intensely hard-fought primary that McConnell won fairly handily.
Yes.
But people point out it's true. McConnell was out there doing get-out-the-vote operations. Mitch McConnell has buried the hatchet. He is a, you know, a big man who is willing to put aside, let bygones be bygones. He was applauding Bevin the whole time, and it looks like Bevin obviously, you know, certainly didn't turn down the support. I don't know how, whether these men are all, you know, hearts and flowers and buddy buddy anymore, but. It does demonstrate Kentucky Republicans pulled it together. Also, maybe an interesting indicator about the gay marriage fight and the issuing of the licenses down there. So again, top to bottom, the only good news for Democrats was the state Supreme Court fights in Pennsylvania. Other than that, they pretty much got shellacked last night. Not surprised that we've seen an era of Democrats doing very poorly in midterms and off year elections. But man, last night was was brutal for them, and maybe an indicator that they've been relying on the magic of Obama and his turnout for a little too long now.
Yeah, we got a year to find out if that's true for the presidential races as well. Let's move on to the bad martini, although one of the issues that we briefly touched on in that good martini will come back for our crazy martini. But let's go to the bad martini, and this broke yesterday. A couple different sources here, first the Daily Caller and then Yahoo. First, the Daily Caller. TransCanada, the company trying to build the Keystone XL oil pipeline, asked the Obama administration to suspend the project's application after 7 years of waiting for the president's approval. TransCanada's move comes amid reports President Barack Obama will reject Keystone's application, and after Canada's Liberal Party made huge gains in last month's election. Republican lawmakers blamed Obama for TransCanada's decision to suspend the application, with Lisa Murkowski saying, instead of saying yes to jobs and North American energy security, the administration continues to say no by its failure to make a decision on approving the Keystone XL pipeline until it becomes someone else's problem or until those who are attempting to invest in new American jobs simply give up. Here, that's frustrating. Here's the galling part. Over at the White House yesterday, Josh Earnest, the president's spokesman, says, it seems unusual to me that somehow it should be paused yet again. So after 7 years of waiting, the Obama administration is now upset with TransCanada for a potential delay in this process.
You know, regarding the Obama administration's approval of this process, I'm going to point to the guys who want to get married and proposal rule, which also applies to vice presidents who take forever to announce that they're going to run for president. Yes. You know, if you want to build the pipeline, you decide to approve to build the pipeline. That basically, you know, the we haven't decided yet is a way of saying no for the past 7 years. I think it's pretty clear this administration. There's an interesting exchange that Obama had earlier in the week, Greg, where he basically said to some group, well, there will be a decision by the end of our presidency. So, Greg, if this is totally out of his hands and he has no influence on whatsoever, he doesn't have his thumb on the scale, he's not calling somebody or pressuring him, this is all being done on the science, it's all being done based on the data and all that kind of stuff, how does he know it's going to be done by then?
Good question.
Right? So, I mean, it's reasonable for us to say, hey, you know, if 7 years, like, most of us could look at it and figure this out in an afternoon. I think the endless delay process is a way of kill the nemesis of the Greens and the environmental movement without actually taking the hit for, you know, destroying a decent job-creating, energy-producing program that, again, brings us closer ties to those nefarious Canadians as opposed to those good old Saudi Arabians and other Middle Eastern regimes who were, you know, getting oil from. So, again, a frustrating turn of events from this administration, but we're not the least bit surprised by it.
Not at all. Twice the State Department approved this, and the Obama administration still said all the facts weren't in. The TransCanada has had the patience of Job in this process, and the fact that they are interested perhaps in exploring another avenue, which will probably mean a pipeline to the Pacific coast and shipping it all to China, is probably not too far in the offing. So well done.
You know, Greg, I don't think the story didn't turn out that well for Job, did it?
Well, in the end it did.
Okay, yeah. It's a good long run, I guess you're right. So, you know.
Yes.
No plague so far, but, you know, night is young.
No. Anyway. No boils yet. No loss of family members. But ultimately, Job was rewarded for his faith. But we'll get to the crazy martini now. And as we mentioned in passing, voters in Houston, Texas, overwhelmingly rejected what became known as the bathroom bill, essentially transgender accommodation. Opponents basically said, we don't want men, whatever, they're thinking about their identity being in women's bathrooms, and the voters of Houston certainly agreed with that argument by a wide margin. It's interesting that the very same day that that vote came down, the U.S. Department of Education, this is the CNN story, found a Chicago area school district discriminated against a transgender student by failing to provide that student full access to girls' locker rooms. The student, who has not been publicly identified, participates on a girls' sports team, but has been required to change and shower separately from teammates and classmates. The Department of Education launched the investigation following a 2013 complaint by the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois, which is representing the student. The quote from Assistant U.S. Secretary for Civil Rights Catherine Lamont, I think is how you say it, all students deserve the opportunity to participate equally in school programs and activities. This is a basic civil right. The school district's statement, we do not agree with the decision and remain strong in our belief that the district's course of action, including private changing stations in our locker rooms, appropriately serves the dignity and privacy of all students in our educational environment. So, Jim, it's pretty hard to accuse this district of being bigoted when they let a biological male play on a girls' sports team, but apparently that's not good enough for the Obama administration.
Just kind of a great little revealing point. Like, if you have this attitude where, look, if you pee standing up, you should be using a urinal. This is basic idea of what constitutes male, what constitutes female. That has been decreed bigotry. And it's not like we had a referendum on this, although I guess you could say in Houston they did. It's not like, you know, this was just basically decreed by our cultural elites that somebody who feels like a woman must be treated like a woman. And all other factors cannot – they can't even be brought up lest you be seen as a terrible homophobic bigot and things like that. This is a bridge too far for the folks who want to completely overturn traditional cultural values. And it's now a matter of basically telling you you have to be okay with effectively unisex bathrooms all around the country. One other little kind of asterisk I will add to that, when you see the Department of Education jumping in on this and telling these schools what they have to do, one of the big problems Jeb Bush has in the presidential primary is the sense that he's out of touch with the grassroots and he's been pushing for Common Core. Now, even if you thought Common Core was the greatest thing in the world and it was just trying to set high standards and just trying to get the kids to do better, how can you look at this Department of Education and trust them with anything, Greg?
You can't.
I mean, like, again, if they will start coming in and start dictating who gets to use which bathroom in a school, they will dictate everything. And they are not considering, they are not respectful of parents. They are not respectful of local districts. They are not respectful of anybody's viewpoints but their own. They are little autocrats, and they, you know, this is not a circumstance in which you can trust them with setting curriculum. You cannot trust them with any of these things. The problem with American schools is not the problems that Common Core is trying to fix. The problem with American schools is this giant education bureaucracy that is, you know, basically blatantly disregarding the will of parents and the people who are the customers, so to speak, the kids and the parents who need them to educate their kids. So just a frustrating circumstance all around, a appropriately crazy martini. And we had a really good start to the martinis today, Greg, and now I feel kind of frustrated.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out that this is not an issue just affecting this one school district in Illinois. It's affecting a number of districts even around the Washington, D.C. area, including the county where you live, and probably headed to other counties, including the one where I live. So we'll see where it goes. But this administration has been pushing its thumb on local school districts in several different places, not just this one near Chicago.
Indeed. A lot of awkward conversations on the home front. So there you go. Like, we don't want to have those conversations any earlier than we have to. So thanks, school boards.
Yes, exactly. The good news is you get to have them before I do. So send me your crib notes. Jim, on that note, talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.